Hello, and welcome to the RAF Museum podcast. Today we have a lecture on the birth of a Royal Air Force Museum by Peter Elliott. This was originally planned to be delivered as part of the museum's Legacy of War lectures. However, with recent circumstances, we've had to rearrange the lecture series, and Peter has kindly recorded an abridged version of his talk, which I think you'll find both insightful and informative. Now, Peter is the perfect man to give this talk. He retired from the RAF Museum in 2016 after more than 31 years, latterly as head of archives, and was then appointed the museum's first curator emeritus. Prior to joining the museum, Peter worked as a librarian for the Ministry of Defence, including 2 years at the Royal Aircraft Establishment. He's been a member of the Royal Aeronautical Society's historical group since 1998, and chaired that committee from 2012 to 2020. Currently, he's studying for a PhD at the University of Hertfordshire, focused on the development of aviation museums in the UK. So, without any further ado, here is Peter Elliott, giving his talk on A Tortuous Birth, the Royal Air Force Museum, 41 years in the making.
The Royal Air Force Museum was opened in 1972, some 41 years after the RAF had first looked to set up its own museum, and 54 years after the RAF was formed. Why did it take so long? Why was a museum felt necessary? And how did it come to be at Hendon? Why does the United Kingdom not have a National Air Museum? This podcast will answer those questions and describe the attempts to set up an RAF museum in the 1930s and the reasons for their failure, the search for a site, battles with the Treasury, and what might have been. A look at some of the plans to expand the RAF museum in the 1970s and 1980s. The successful creation of the museum was due to the work of two people, Marshal of the Royal Air Force Sir Dermot Boyle and Dr. John Tanner. Dr. Tanner often claimed that the idea of an RAF museum was first mooted in 1917, when Lord Rothermere directed that one example of each type of aircraft used during the war was to be preserved for posterity, to be supplemented later with specimens of aircraft introduced into the Royal Air Force. Rothermere had indeed directed that aircraft should be preserved, but he wanted them to go to the Imperial War Museum, the IWM. Nearly 80 aircraft were selected, of which about half were eventually delivered and stored at the Agricultural Hall in Islington. None of those have survived. The first World War aircraft in the IWM came via a separate route. The Imperial War Museum opened in the Crystal Palace in 1920 and moved to its current site in Lambeth in 1936, by which time the RAF had already tried twice to establish its own museum. By 1931, the RAF was unhappy about the way it was represented in the IWM. The museum's remit didn't extend beyond the end of the First World War, so most of the RAF's life and work was not represented. A paper discussed by the Air Council noted that there was no institutional building for the preservation of the records of the flying services, and there was concern that aircraft, equipment and documents of much historical value would be lost for all time. Whilst the IWM and the Science Museum had collections of aircraft, it was difficult to find adequate space for the air services in a mixed museum. The Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, also had a museum which included some aeronautical material. The paper argued that the RAF would be overshadowed in the IWM by the other services. The space allocated to the Air Force was only about 20% of that allocated to the Army and the Royal Navy. The exhibition was dominated by heavy weaponry. Was this desire for a museum purely corporate vanity? There's probably a deeper root than that. For much of its life, the RAF has faced calls from the Army and Navy for it to be disbanded and its resources reallocated to the services from which it was formed. The RAF, as the junior service, fought to establish its national identity in the 1920s and 1930s. This was particularly important as much of the RAF's work was overseas, in areas such as Iraq, Transjordan and the Northwest Frontier. Events such as air displays at Hendon, the Schneider Trophy races, in which the RAF flew the British aircraft, and record-breaking flights kept the RAF in the public eye. An RAF museum would have been a very effective shop window for the service. Unfortunately, the time wasn't right. The Wall Street crash had led to a worldwide depression. There was mass unemployment in the UK and public spending was under great pressure. There was no money for a new museum, so some temporary measures were suggested, including a survey of historical records held by RAF stations, and some space might be found to store them. The document closed with general questions. Should the scheme include both military and civil aviation? It acknowledged the argument that the latter could be covered by the Science Museum, but there were arguments both ways. What about relations with the IWM, which covered only the First World War? Some war period material would be appropriate for the Air Ministry scheme. And how might the scheme relate to other service museums? The museum would presumably be imperial as well as British, which suggests that it would include the air forces founded in Australia, Canada, India and New Zealand in the 1920s and 30s. The Air Council agreed that an aeronautical museum was desirable and to store suitable exhibits at RAF Cardington. A letter was sent to all commands asking for lists of items of general and technical interest, including aspects such as personnel, technical development and armament, as well as written and printed records. There's a rather light-hearted reply from the Air Officer Commanding RAF Middle East, who asked for clarification, saying, "It occurs to me that a set of Air Force lists would best preserve the history of the personnel of the Royal Air Force." Now, the Air Force list gives details of officers, which suggests that he thought the other ranks perhaps need not be represented. Air Vice Marshal Newell went on to become Chief of the Air Staff in the late 1930s and was awarded a peerage. Some 4 years later, the Council discussed Memorandum 570, the Museum Interests of the Air Ministry. It reported on the IWM's planned move to Lambeth and noted that only 3 aircraft could be accommodated in its air section, with one more in each of the naval and army sections. Another 5 aircraft would revert to RAF ownership for the Air Services Museum. Only 2 of those 5 have survived, the Sopwith triplane in Hangar 2 at Hendon and the LVG currently in store at Cosford. It was suggested that a system be set up to earmark aircraft and engines as they pass out of service. The memorandum gave brief comments on the Science Museum and other collections, concluding that they were already collecting items for which an Air Services Museum, if it existed, would have first claim. In other words, the RAF was losing opportunities. The Science Museum had been reducing the more specialised aviation exhibits to a minimum, but was now reversing this policy, and it was seeking to take over a large proportion of the objects that it had stored on behalf of the IWM. The Air Council agreed that there was no possibility of obtaining a suitable building for the museum. Material currently held in stores depots would be retained, and examples of current equipment worthy of permanent retention would be earmarked as they became obsolete. But once again, the time wasn't right to create a museum. The rise of Hitler and German rearmament had brought a change in defence policy, and in 1934, the first of several RAF expansion schemes was announced. Building up numbers of aircraft, constructing more RAF stations and recruiting personnel was obviously a much higher priority and very expensive. The air estimates for 1935 sought a total of nearly £26 million, an increase of nearly 48% on the £17.6 million requested the previous year. The Air Services Museum had, once again, to go onto the back burner, and would remain so for more than 20 years. During the Second World War, the Air Ministry's Air Historical Branch gathered documents and objects of historical interest, while the IWM, with its remit broadened to include the Second World War, was also collecting material. In 1945, control of civil flying was moved from the Air Ministry to the new Ministry of Civil Aviation, leaving the former in charge of military flying, although the Admiralty and the War Office also represented the air interests of the Royal Navy and Army. With the country trying to recover from the physical and economic legacy of the war, an aviation museum, whether focused on the RAF, civil aviation or both, was unlikely to receive much support. In 1953, an editorial in the magazine The Aeroplane called for improvements in the Science Museum's aeronautics display, A major impetus came in January 1954, when the Royal Aeronautical Society announced that it had agreed to purchase the Nash collection of historic aircraft. During 1953, Richard Nash had decided to dispose of his collection, and fears were expressed that the collection might vanish overseas. In November, he'd received an offer from America. Nash had presumably approached the Shuttleworth Trust, since Air Commodore Alan Wheeler, a trustee, had written an article the previous November discussing the need for a national museum. Whilst almost half the article is devoted to the Trust's work, Wheeler wrote, "But nothing the Shuttleworth collection or any other private venture, such as Mr. Nash's valuable collection, can do will fill the requirements for a comprehensive museum of aviation organised nationally." He suggested that a combined effort, sponsored by the Royal Aero Club, might go a long way to launching the project. "In the meantime," he said, "the most pressing need is to collect all the items which should go into such a museum. They could be listed as the property of a national museum when it's finally formed." This article brought a response from Nash, who explained that in addition to the 14 aircraft in his collection, built between 1908 and 1920, another 16 had been destroyed during the war. In the late 1940s, he'd proposed an exhibition at the Crystal Palace site, the new London airport, and in central London. He suggested that a national museum should cover the period to 1945 and then include landmarks up to the ending of the jet era and the initial atomic-powered period. The Royal Aeronautical Society called a meeting in October 1954 to consider the creation of a national aeronautical collection of historical aircraft. The 17 organisations attending included government departments, national museums, and various aviation groups. The meeting was chaired by Peter Masefield, evidently the driving force behind this initiative. Masefield's career had included board appointments at Bristol Aircraft and British European Airways. He was president of the Royal Aeronautical Society from 1959 to 60. Masefield had already written to Lord Trenchard and other senior officers seeking their support for the foundation of a national aeronautical collection. Trenchard duly wrote to the chief of the air staff expressing his support. The meeting agreed that some form of national collection was desirable, and Masefield suggested that it could be located at Croydon Airport or RAF Hendon. In particular, they would like the Graham White Hangar, our Hangar 2. A working party was formed to carry the project forward. Although the Air Ministry seems to have supported the project, there were dissenting voices. Air Vice Marshal Jordan pointed out the need for hangar space, which would grow as more aircraft joined the collection, and suggested that using models and photographs would be more attractive than aircraft, concluding that "a hangar in the winter is a cold, damp and drafty place, and I cannot see crowds of people trooping out to this kind of hangar at Hendon to see a national collection of historic aircraft." Nevertheless, the Aeronautical Society continued discussions with the Air Ministry and drafted lists of British and foreign aircraft and engines that could form the national collection. The aircraft lists were eventually published in 1959. Plaques would be presented to the owners of aircraft considered to be of historic importance. Many of the listed aircraft still survive, and a few are still airworthy. The discussions with the Royal Aeronautical Society evidently made the RAF and Air Ministry reconsider their historic aircraft. In 1956, there had been criticism regarding the condition of aircraft in the annual Battle of Britain display in London, and the future of the display was in doubt. It might be possible to lend some of those aircraft to the Shuttleworth Trust, but the Trust was not keen. It saw its role as preserving and operating the early aircraft collected by the late Richard Shuttleworth, and it was felt that the Trust's tradesmen did not have the skills required to deal with relatively modern aircraft. In fact, Nash had written to Shuttleworth in December 1939, "After this war, we will have to try and add a Heinkel, Messerschmitt, Spitfire and Hurricane to our collections, as these in 20 or 30 years' time will be just as ancient as our pups and camels." The Trust would need more hangar space, for which the Air Ministry might have to foot the bill indirectly. Some of the RAF's wartime aircraft could go to the Science Museum, but it would be difficult to borrow them back. The Royal Aeronautical Society was offered a Spitfire and Hurricane for the RAF to exhibit every September, but there's no trace of their response. There was little enthusiasm in the Ministry of Works, which was responsible for the National Museum's premises, for another museum. Officials were sceptical about the appeal of an aviation museum, since aviation had a relatively brief history. They were also concerned that the creation of an air museum would encourage the army to demand similar treatment, and feared that their funding would suffer. It was acknowledged, however, that Britain was playing a leading part in aeronautics, and it may be that eventually there ought to be some sort of museum of this kind. The Treasury was similarly unimpressed. The army was trying to establish its own museum, and one official wrote, "If we go high and handsome about an army museum, we shall find the RAF wanting something done for them." Another concluded, "This project should be played long and killed, with kindness if possible." The National Air Museum project was eventually shelved when the Treasury made it clear that it preferred to spend considerably more on existing national institutions, and that aviation was already represented in the IWM and Science Museum's collections. Around this time, the Air Ministry was preparing to move into new accommodation in Whitehall, now the Ministry of Defence main building. The Ministry's Historic Aircraft Working Party proposed in 1959 that displays should be set up in the reception hall of the new building and in the Air Council suite. The former would be open to the public at weekends, but this was ruled out as it would be too small, and objections were raised about turning part of the Air Ministry into a peep show, together with concerns over small boy trouble. The working party was succeeded in 1962 by the Air Ministry's Historical Advisory Committee, chaired by Marshal of the Royal Air Force Sir Dermot Boyle. He'd been part of a committee reviewing the Roussy's Museum collection, as that museum was closing and new homes had to be found for the collection. His new committee's task was to advise the Air Council on the identification, acquisition, preservation and display of articles of historic aircraft to the RAF and to the nation. Their first interim report highlighted the lack of a new official museum in the Royal Air Force as compared with the Army and Navy, and urged the formation of an RAF museum. The ideal location would be in London, but it was recognised that this was not achievable. A formal paper proposing the formation of the RAF Museum was submitted to the Treasury by the Air Ministry in September 1962. The Treasury staff were wary, describing the request as a shrewd move, for it makes it a little more difficult to reject out of hand, and they were concerned about both the requirement for hangar space and the danger that the project may be used as a means of keeping open an airfield which could otherwise be sold, thereby depriving the Treasury of both savings and the income from the sale. Nevertheless, Treasury approval in principle was granted in 1962, and the committee searched for a site. A hangar at RAF Upavon in Wiltshire proved to have woodworm and other defects, and therefore was discounted. The committee also stressed the need to appoint a curator, and Dr. John Tanner was appointed in 1963. Tanner had been the librarian at the RAF College Cranwell and had created the college's museum. He'd written to Boyle regarding the Roussy closure, and in May 1962 sent him a paper outlining his thoughts on how an RAF museum might be created. Tanner pointed out that there was much public interest in the RAF, and that a Royal Air Force museum would in time be a major public attraction and one that could yield benefits to the service disproportionate to its cost. The RAF would reach its 50th anniversary in 1968, and the time to start a service museum is when the service is young, not when much of the material has been given time to disappear. He argued that the best place for the museum would be Cranwell. The officer cadets at the college were perhaps the most important group of young people in the service, and pointed out that the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst was home to the National Army Museum. He implied that the RAF's future leaders, Cranwell prepared men for long-term commissioned service, would be inspired by the deeds of their predecessors and go on to make further RAF history. A museum at Cranwell would also have recruiting power. Exhibits might include personalia, documents, uniforms and decorations, but there was no suggestion that aircraft would be included. The spaces Tanner identified were far too small for even the smaller aircraft. and he put emphasis on using modern display techniques, including dioramas and working models. Boyle became the first chairman of the museum's trustees. Early in 1963, he wrote to the ministry's permanent undersecretary, suggesting that a historic aircraft museum be formed at Henlow in Bedfordshire as a separate project from the Royal Air Force Museum, and pointing out that the location could attract a large audience if the display of these aircraft to the public were deemed desirable. Discussions within the Air Ministry led to support for such a collection as a training aid for engineers. It's difficult to determine whether this was an alternative to the idea of an RAF museum, or a sort of Trojan horse attempt by Sir Dermot to get a foothold on a site suitably close to London. He'd written to Alan Wheeler the previous October, outlining the sort of shape of things to come, which included an RAF museum with only one or two aircraft, which would ultimately be in London, but initially would be elsewhere in the country, and a historic aircraft museum for the static display of aircraft located on a suitable airfield. It might be possible to fly some of the aircraft, but that would depend on suitable financial arrangements. It's noteworthy that Henlow is close to the Shuttleworth Collections site at Old Warden. In 1964, it was announced in Parliament that the Royal Air Force Museum would be sited at RAF Henlow. It was proposed that the museum would open in 1968 to mark the 50th anniversary of the RAF's formation. The museum was still hopeful of obtaining a site in London, although government policy preferred siting major national institutions in the provinces. Boyle had inspected the disused Brompton Underground station, and Tanner declined an offer of space at Kensington Palace. Much energy was expended on campaigning for a site on the Mall, which is now occupied by the Institute of Contemporary Arts. It would not be capable of accommodating aircraft, which would be made available at Henlow for research by serious students. Negotiations with the Crown Estate Commissioners dragged on into 1966. Peter Masefield also contributed to the search for a site, suggesting in a letter to the Times that there was a site which appears to be unused and suitable in the museum area of South Kensington, the site once reserved for the National Theatre, now to be elsewhere. That was Cromwell Gardens, opposite the V&A. Intriguingly, the museum's archive includes drawings, dated 1965, of an RAF museum building on the site currently occupied by the National Theatre, on the South Bank. No other reference to this site has been found. Finally, in May 1967, the Treasury agreed that the museum would be sited at RAF Hendon, which had a rich history dating from its foundation as the London Aerodrome in 1910. The site would be made over to the trustees for 99 years, the construction of the building funded by an appeal, and the running costs paid by the Ministry of Defence. The RAF Museum was opened by Her Majesty the Queen on 15th of November 1972. The Central Aircraft Hall displayed a range of aircraft in chronological order, while 11 galleries told the story of military flying and included dioramas, models, artifacts and uniforms, with one gallery devoted to winners of the George Cross and Victoria Cross. Gallery 11, the RAF Today, was funded by the RAF's Inspector of Recruiting. The new museum immediately proved very popular, so popular, in fact, that the number of toilets proved inadequate. The Treasury declined a request for funds to build more toilets. A Treasury official stated, "If we give an inch with Dr. Tanner, we're likely to be asked for a mile." In the early 1970s, Tanner campaigned more openly for a National Aviation Museum, emphasising the RAF's major contribution to British aviation. A significant number of aircraft in the RAF's historic collection were not on public display, and expanding the RAF Museum's estate and remit would enable him to create further exhibitions. The Department for Education and Science convened a meeting in September 1974 between the Royal Air Force Museum, Science Museum, Imperial War Museum and Ministry of Defence to discuss future acquisition policy, the relationships between the museums and whether civil aircraft should be displayed at airports or alongside military aircraft. A briefing paper for the new Chairman of Trustees, written by Tanner in 1975, states that his 1962 paper was on the need for a national air museum and how it could be started, and this paper was adopted as basic policy, but his paper is only about an RAF museum. The briefing paper continued, the name was a problem. Logically, it should be the National Aviation Museum, but the bulk of air history is linked closely with the Royal Air Force. And he added that the best site was in the hands of the Royal Air Force, as were most of the exhibits, and the service's emotive appeal would make it easier to raise the £1 million needed for the building. Might this suggest that Tanner's intention had been to create the RAF Museum as the thin end of a wedge which would broaden out a wider remit? Or was he exploiting the very positive public response to the RAF Museum's opening? Tanner wrote a lengthy paper outlining a plan for the museum's future, calling for the establishment of the National Air Museum, an umbrella title sheltering several bodies. The RAF Museum would retain its name with the subheading the National Air Museum. Expansion of the RAF Museum using sites at Biggin Hill and Gaydon. The RAF's regional collections at sites such as Killearn, Finningley and St Athan would be disbanded, and the aircraft moved to Biggin Hill and Gaydon. There would be no expansion at Hendon until the 1980s, when the RAF was scheduled to leave the site and the museum could take over some of the buildings. The announcement in the 1975 Defence Review that the RAF would leave Biggin Hill, one of the most famous airfields involved in the Battle of Britain, led Tanner to propose setting up a Battle of Britain museum there. He warned that the RAF museum was in danger of being outstripped. Other institutions, and one great one in particular, will quite properly try to assume the task. This seems to allude to the IWM's expansion of its Duxford site. He had previously written to the Greater London Council, outlining a scheme for a Battle of Britain display at Alexandra Palace. Neither project went ahead, but the trustees of the RAF Museum approved the creation of a building at Hendon dedicated to the Battle of Britain. The Ministry of Defence refused to fund either the construction or the running costs, so it became a separate organisation, the Battle of Britain Museum, with the same trustees as the RAF Museum. It opened in 1978. An appeal raised money for the new museum. The running costs were covered by admission charges, but entry to the RAF Museum remained free. Tanner's 1975 aid memoir for the new Chairman of Trustees states that the trustees had agreed that the RAF Museum should do for the air what the National Maritime Museum does for the sea, and tell the story of the flying services as they, and the RAF in particular, created most aviation history. The appeal leaflet issued in 1964 to raise funds for the RAF Museum had stated that it was the only national museum concerned solely with aviation. The many aspects covered include the military and civil. The emphasis is naturally on the unique great achievements in peace and war of the Royal Air Force. The Standing Commission on Museums and Galleries convened a meeting in November 1978, attended by the Fleet Air Arm Museum, IWM, RAF Museum, Royal Scottish Museum and the Science Museum to try to coordinate their collecting. It was agreed to compile a census of historic aircraft in national and departmental museums and those in private hands. The meeting recommended export controls on historic aircraft and encouraged the development of a museum in the north of England. A senior MOD official who attended the meeting later expressed the view that there is no prospect of the RAF Museum becoming the National Aviation Museum. There will be a national collection in which the RAF Museum can play a significant part. In 1979, the RAF Museum took over the running of the RAF's Aerospace Museum at Cosford, one of the service's regional collections under a management agreement. Tanner was an honorary museum advisor to British Airways. Some of the company's retired airliners were displayed at Cosford, and there was a small exhibition at Hendon. Tanner's 1975 plan had included Gaydon as the museum's Midlands branch, and Cosford fulfilled this role. The suggestion of a museum in the north of England led to a joint venture between the RAF Museum and Manchester City Council, the Manchester Air and Space Museum, which opened in 1983. It's now the Air and Space Gallery of the Museum of Science and Industry, part of the Science Museum Group, with many aircraft on loan from the RAF Museum. The final expansion at Hendon during Tanner's directorship was to have been a National Air Museum building, which would include a Bomber Command Hall. Pressure from the Bomber Command Association, a veterans group, persuaded the trustees to give precedence to the Bomber Command Museum. This opened in 1983 and, like the Battle of Britain Museum, relied on an appeal for its construction costs and admission fees for income, and was the subject of a separate trust. In the economic climate of the 1980s, it proved impossible to pay off the loans raised to cover its construction, and in 1987, the MOD agreed a rescue package. The Ministry provided some £1.8 million to clear the debt, to be recovered via reductions in the museum's grant in aid over 5 years. A single admission fee was introduced to cover the original RAF Museum, previously free, and the Battle of Britain and Bomber Command Museums, and work began to amalgamate the three trusts. The reduced grant in aid was not restored at the end of the five-year period. After fighting for some 25 years to establish a National Air Museum, Tanner retired at the end of 1987 and was succeeded by Dr. Michael Fopp. To sum up the story of the RAF Museum's birth, the RAF's desire to have its own museum has its roots in the need to keep the public, particularly taxpayers and potential recruits, aware of its achievements and current operations. For much of the 20th century, money to create such a shop window was not available. Economic crises, preparations for war, and the need to rebuild Britain after the war all claimed higher priorities. By the early 1960s, opportunities were emerging, and John Tanner's vision of an RAF museum came at the right time. It wasn't easy. The Treasury viewed the creation of an aviation museum with disdain and thought it would be of little interest to the public. They had had a similar view of the proposed National Army Museum. The crowds that came to Hendon once the RAF Museum had opened in 1972 proved the Treasury wrong and encouraged Tanner to pursue his vision of a National Air Museum by expanding Hendon, taking over Cosford, and developing a new museum at Manchester. However, funding problems brought this expansion to an end. Dr. Tanner was an authority on heraldry and designed the museum's arms. The motto, Per Ardua Alis, is a variation on the RAF motto, Per Ardua Ad Astra, and was probably inspired by his struggle to set up and expand the museum. One translation is, Through difficulties on wings, which may reflect a quotation from Plautus, chosen by Tanner, that greeted visitors to the newly opened RAF Museum. Flight without feathers is not easy.